Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is Zero Point Radio. Our focus in these discussions is on the investigation of mystical and spiritual occult ideas and relating these to modern science and psychology. We focus on the discussions particularly of human consciousness and the idea of psychology as being a science of the soul. The last century of Western science and education and philosophy has denied the existence of the human spirit or soul and dismissed religions as simply belief systems and irrational and misty belief systems. And in dismissing religions on such a superficial basis, we've also thrown out the psychology of the soul, which is inherent to the religious teachings of different traditions. So in this program, we explore mystical Christianity, Kabbalistic and Judaic mystical teachings, the Vedic and yogic teachings, Tibetan Buddhism. We explore a wide range of esoteric, religious, and mystical teachings, exploring this idea of the psychology of the soul and the psychology of consciousness. And we're also trying to understand ideas from mystical teachings about creation, of creation of the universe and the nature of creation, or the nature of the world. Particularly, I draw upon the Secret Doctrine of Madame Blavatsky, which is a book written in 1888. And Blavatsky said, in our era, no one will consider the Secret Doctrine seriously, but in the era to come, people will realize these teachings have neither been invented nor exaggerated. And my newest book is on God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, and explaining some of the relationships of what Blavatsky was saying over a century ago to the newest ideas in physics and science. And this includes discussion of things such as creation out of the nothingness of the quantum vacuum, and how in physics the vacuum or space is regarded as both empty and as the plenum, or full. The space is full of intelligence and energy and information, all latent within space. Blavatsky also anticipated ideas related to what is currently called seven-dimensional hyperspace. In the newest ideas in physics, they postulate a seven-dimensional hyperspace, which underlies and sustains the four-dimensional space-time. Well, Blavatsky had a similar idea over a century ago. So she talked also of the creation of a cosmos from a point source, and that's the term zero point. The idea of zero point is a point that is so small that it disappears from view. Just like science traces our universe back to a singularity condition, which is a point 10 to the minus 33 centimeters in diameter. So the universe emerged from a first point of differentiation, and then it grows within without from a zero point. And Blavatsky argued that eventually the universe will withdraw without within and return back to a zero point center at the end of time, and back into the absolute and the non-being of the quantum vacuum. So we explored the idea of zero-point dynamics and how even human beings, not only a cosmos, but a human being also has such a zero-point center. Okay, in the last weeks we've had a number of guests on, and we're exploring 9/11 issues and other issues about contemporary political and social situation. We certainly are alive in a very dire times for people, especially in the United States, but throughout the world, we're facing these major crises within our societies. And we've been exploring these themes and issues. And, yeah. So, anyway, we have 2-hour show. I have my regular co-host, James Moffat, on in the background. Jim, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Chris, how are you?
Okay, and nice autumn day up here.
Yes, beautiful here, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, any thoughts?
I don't know if you got that email that I sent you about 10 days ago. Actually, I sent it to you on your birthday. Belated happy birthday, by the way. About The Spiritual Brain by Mariel Beauregard and Denise O'Leary. It's a book. Mariel Beauregard is a neuroscientist in Montreal.
And
Denise O'Leary is a journalist, science journalist, who resides in Toronto. She had a book out a few years ago called By Design or By Chance, in which she, I've just glanced at it. I have not read the book, but it's a very interesting compilation of all sorts of information around the addressing the issue of intelligent design, and she's provides a lot of information, scientific information, but she's also, her perspective is that of spiritual perspective. I believe she's a Roman Catholic. She's a Christian, and very, very informed perspective on things. And so I picked up this book, The Spiritual Brain, and Mariel Beauregard has done research with Carmelite nuns on spiritual experience and mystical experience, and studied them. And I just read the introduction to the book and the first chapter, and I was really quite impressed. It's a very, very interesting take on things. He completely dismisses the materialist perspective as a comprehensive explanation for spiritual experiences and for consciousness. It says that the evidence is overwhelming that we have to go beyond that. And has a very, I thought, a very, very informed and interesting discussion. It, certainly, in terms of your work, I think he as a neurologist, he's looking at the brain aspect of spiritual experience, but he's very very adamant that the idea of a God particle, that God is reducible to some sort of event in the brain, that some sort of aberration, that these, he says, are quite nonsensical ideas, and that they are not consistent with the evidence whatsoever. And he says there's something beyond this, and it's not material. And he's as I say, I was very impressed with the material. I've just read the beginnings of the book, but it's
the book, The Spiritual Brain, not O'Leary's other book.
I'm sorry.
This is the
book with Beauregard. It's very very interesting and very exciting to read. So, in light of all these books out, you know, that are trying to explain God away and spiritual experience as being some sort of narcissistic self-absorption, or that God is not great, as Christopher Hitchens says, or that, you know, God delusion, as Richard Dawkins says. It's really interesting to read, especially a neurologist who is not a materialist. And he says, you know, this is a conventional thinking about things, and this is something that's emphatically asserted all the time, but he says the evidentiary basis for this is just not there, and in fact that you have to go beyond the material to explain the nature of spiritual experience and in his opinion consciousness, which I thought was, it's very exciting to read somebody who actually says that, you know, other than you.
Well, that's interesting. I'd look forward to try to get a copy of that and read that.
I got you one. I'll send it up to you. It's
I've lost my computer. It won't start up for me.
Oh,
so
no.
It's been very awkward for me for several weeks now.
Oh, that's not good.
It would kind of start up, and then it just collapses, and now it won't even start. And
uh-oh.
Haven't at the moment had the money to take it in yet to get it repaired.
Yeah.
It's been hard living without a computer and feeling much out of touch.
Yeah. That's really, it's funny how, you know, even thinking back 10, 15 years, you know, when I think I really didn't, I was sort of late to the game in getting a computer, but it's like, it's such, you know, a huge part of my life that even when my computer was down for a couple of days last year when I had some problems too, it's like you become so used to, you know, connecting to so many different sources of information and organizing your work in terms of, it's very hard to not have it. It's a really strange experience now. Well, anyway, so yeah, there's that book, and
that's interesting. In that book, I guess you haven't read it yet, so you can't really. But what strikes me as the spiritual brain.
Yeah.
Whereas,
well,
if I were to say what my work is about, it's about the spiritual heart.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because, like, the way I would see the spiritual brain is if I believe the monadic essence of the jiva atma, or this there's this inner light element within the higher dimensions of the human heart, and that it's the light of that which can illuminate the mind. So I would see the spiritual brain is attained once a person awakens in the heart, and then that can illuminate the mind in the head. So I would see the illumination of the mind in the head as being secondary to the awakening of the consciousness within the heart. But it'll be interesting to have a look at that book and see if he ever considers a deeper notion that, well, maybe a human being as a whole system might, you know, would include the heart.
Yeah, I don't know to what extent. I get the impression that I think he'd be very interested in your perspective on these things, because he seems very open-minded. Like, he insists that the brain and the mind are two different things.
Yeah.
So, from what I gather, I didn't see anything that suggests that he would... that he would be articulating anything akin to what you call the heart doctrine, and he seems quite informed on mystical experiences. So, you know, but having said that, I mean, it's interesting to me that so many people who are informed about mystical experiences and have some more than a passing familiarity with them seem to really miss this idea of the heart doctrine, and the idea that the I experience arises in the metaphysical dimensions of the heart, and that consciousness arises in the heart and is to be compared in the mystical teachings with the sun, which illuminates the psychic functions of which occur in the brain and in the mind in the brain, so that the brain is more like the moon and the heart is the sun, and that the life source is this spiritual spark within the physical and metaphysical dimensions of the heart, whereby the higher levels of consciousness descend through various levels and involve into a human being through the heart and provide provide consciousness and the life principle, which circulates through the blood and through the hormones and the various material processes which inform and energize the brain and the body.
Yeah, and I mean, it's interesting too, because I think you can have also that you can have spiritual experiences involving the mind and the brain in the head without having been awakened in the heart.
Yeah,
like, I don't think that's necessary to have been awakened in the heart to, like, for instance, some teachings focus on meditating or opening the third eye. And I think people can awaken the third eye and have mystical visions or experiences through the awakening of the third eye, and be within that realm, without having first awakened within the heart. I think awakening within the heart is valuable for people, because then if you awaken in the third eye, then you don't get as lost into Never Never Land and the psychical realms. That in a way you want to be established within the heart and then awaken higher centers. But sometimes people awaken higher centers without being established in the heart. I mean, I remember
that's a really good
the
point. Yeah,
story of Gopi Krishna, I think, was very, very interesting. And when he had his kundalini arising, and it manifested through his brow chakra. So he had these mystical visions, and for months, even years, he had to be looked after his body by his disciples and carried around, and he was in the realms of the mind. But he was, and even when he came back, it took him months before he had any normal feeling or emotional experience again.
Huh.
So he had all these kind of profound mystical experiences, but all really quite divorced from the awakening of the heart.
Yeah.
And then I read a book like that one I highly recommend, The Science of Soul by Sarasvati. I'm not sure how to pronounce the fellow's name. And he says, all states of samadhi, he says, they are all established based on the awakening of the heart. So he sees the awakening of the heart as like establishing the basis for samadhi experiences and then awakening higher levels of samadhi or levels of the mind. But there do seem, you know, it's an interesting subject, but it makes sense to me that, you know, you want to be established within the heart, and then you maintain some sense of I, even into the psychical realm. Whereas Gopi Krishna kind of got lost into the psychical realm, but he wasn't anchored in that experience of his I-ness.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really interesting distinction. It's another kind of angle on this whole relationship between the brain and the heart, and you know, the mind and the head, and the awakening of the heart is the means of awakening higher states of consciousness. Because, in a sense, like when people take various psychedelic drugs and substances, which can open your mind to higher states of consciousness, I think that happens quite frequently, where people haven't got a properly integrated sense of self or identity, and it can be very damaging, and even lead to, you know, serious psychological problems if people take too strong a dose of some of these drugs. And I think that's essentially what happens, is that something occurs in their brains, which really they're not prepared to be able to process, or there's not that sense of integration, so it can be kind of really disruptive to the sense of psyche.
Yeah, and then afterwards they can have a real hard time coming down and having a sense of selfness
right.
again.
Yeah.
Yeah, and being lost in the mind realms. I've seen that too.
Yeah.
People.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because I mean it's something that I never quite really thought about it all that much in terms of the heart doctrine, but it seems like that's an interesting perspective that would sort of reinforce that, and that's why people place such emphasis on awakening the heart and rather than trying to pursue just these experiences, the spiritual or mystical experiences in and of themselves. Like, I think, you know, various teachers have said that, you know, these experiences can be valuable and can, you know, lead to insight into things, but to pursue them without sort of laying the groundwork in terms of overcoming the obstacles to awakening of the self and of the heart, you know, it can be actually quite dangerous and very misleading, in terms of you think that you're seeking something, but really you're in a sense falling into kind of a trap of titillation or of diversion on some level.
Yeah, Adi Da talks about it in that way too. He talks about getting lost, and people getting lost through the brow chakra and into the psychical realms. Yeah, but he says the way of the heart is the most immediate way to the ultimate realization. But he says you can attain it through these explorations of the mind, but only after a long kind of period of exploring and then coming back and reintegrating.
Yeah, he's pretty adamant about that the way that the opening of the heart is the key to truly experiencing. I think he, perhaps, I don't know his work that well, but I guess the sense that what he's saying in a sense is that unless you awaken the heart, unless you break the knots in the heart, you're sort of still involved in the egoic sense of self, and that you can't really go beyond that, like you can't really achieve the higher states of self-realization. You can't, because you can't lose yourself. You're still sort of anchored in these knots in the heart of identity and self-contraction. Is that what would something like that that he would say?
That you would still be your essential awareness of being is obscured within the heart because of the knots of the heart. So you have that basic contraction within the heart. Yeah, so you want to undo that contraction, the heart contraction, first. I like this quote. This is interesting because we hear today, well, here's a quote from Blavatsky from The Voice of the Silence. She says, learn above all to separate head learning from soul wisdom, the I from the heart doctrine. But even ignorance is better than head learning with no soul wisdom to illuminate and guide it. The doctrine of the I is for the crowd, the doctrine of the heart for the elect. Great Sifter is the name of the heart doctrine. So that's very interesting because it seems particularly relevant today because we hear so much talk of the Illuminati and their symbol of the awakened third eye and the triangle. And in a way, that's the eye doctrine. And Blavatsky would recognize the faculties awakened through the eye doctrine. But she would tend to say that's more into the realm of what she calls the astral light. So there's like on the lower planes is the astral light, and then there's the higher dimensional ether is the Akasha. So she sees the awakening of the eye is related more to the astral light. Because I think a lot of the elites through their black magic practices actually do acquire psychical powers on lower levels. But in this false, what Blavatsky would call ultimately a false realm of the astral light. So that's a very interesting quote suggesting that the doctrine of the heart is for the elect, that in a way it's a deeper teaching. And I see the heart is, as a person's heart goes, so does the soul, because the soul is connected to the heart. And if we're not awakened in the heart, we can lose ourselves. There's a certain emptiness in the heart, and we can be lost in that emptiness without a sense of I-ness. And we want to maintain this inner I awareness. So that's a quote from The Voice of the Silence.
Yeah, so like what we're describing is kind of like when, in Gurdjieff's terms, he talks about people achieving some level of awakening in the different centers, and if they're not properly coordinated and balanced, then they can crystallize improperly. Like that's kind of what he would say is that they're crystallized, their sense of self becomes crystallized in one of the centers to the exclusion of the others or the underdevelopment of the others, and that this can lead to the acquisition and acquisition of powers and the apprehension of higher dimensions and you know experiences that are beyond the normal waking state of consciousness, but that this is not real awakening because you're improperly fixed in this according to whatever center you've overdeveloped, whether it's the physical or the emotional or the intellectual center. So
he talks about that when he talks also about what he calls the Hasnamas individuals, which are the kind of despicable creatures he describes. He calls various Hasnamas. I don't know the derivation of that word, what it means. But he describes them as kind of always seeking their own satisfaction and not caring how much suffering or adversity they cause others and you know wanting to destroy all other living breathing creatures and So he describes, he says there, hasnama, sometimes he says there, they only consist of a physical body. But then there are other hasnamas who's attained their astral and mental bodies, and they've developed their higher being bodies. But he describes that when they die, they persist in the realm where this formation of the higher being bodies has to be broken down because it's been wrongly formulated. So that's like the hell conditions is like where, that's how I see afterlife conditions in the way they break down these complexes that have been crystallized surrounding the essential I identity. So, yeah, it's like a melting pot. It's like all this wrong formulation in people has to be broken down or dissolved, and that's like part of the hell experience. So he has that idea of there being these hasnamas individuals who can attain these higher powers, but they're wrongly formulated. And I think it again turns on the level of the heart and the awakening of the heart. I mean, we see this in Gurdjieff also because he says the first level of elevated consciousness is self-consciousness. And he describes that as involving the awakening of the higher emotional center. And then he sees the objective states of consciousness. That's like the further attainment of the mental body. And that ideally would follow from self-consciousness. You wouldn't want a person awakening into experiences objective consciousness. As Gurdjieff says, he might go mad, like a person gets so lost in the realms of the mind that he might go mad. So really you want to attain the more law conformable method of development would be to awaken in the heart center and then experience the higher intellectual center and the higher faculties of the mind, like the spiritual brain or the spiritual mind. So, I mentioned the last time, Jim, that we might read that Talks with the Devil by Uspensky for today, but I got my book dug out, but I never got through that. I don't know. You hadn't had a chance to read that,
yeah,
had you?
I had an even worse experience. I can't find my copy, so it's been a long time since I've read it, but so I have a very, very vague idea about it, but my recollection in general is that if I'm not mistaken, is doesn't he equate to sort of the devil is sort of roughly equated with the state of mechanicalness or the lack of consciousness, the lack of self-consciousness? Isn't that basically his point, is that it's not so much that the devil is an external force, but it's sort of a property of the psyche of people in waking sleep. Is that?
I saw it differently. I mean, I wanted to go back to try to understand it again, but partly he kind of saw the devil like not seeing themselves as a devil. Like the devil thinks he's right, kind of.
Okay.
But he doesn't see into the higher realms. So if a person at death were to ascend and pass into the higher spiritual world, from the perspective of the devil, well then that person is failing to exist. So to escape into the spiritual world, see, from the devil's perspective, oh, he's gone, that's death. But so the devil thinks that you want to stay in the lower planes because that's how you maintain your existence.
Oh, okay.
So, we'll come to it sometime in the show in the future. We'll pick up on that.
Yeah.
I wondered at times how that might apply to the elites in the world today.
Hmm.
Because they kind of seem to think in a way that they're, you know, they got this higher calling, this kind of great New World Order plan, kind of what I call the New World Psychiatric Disorder plan, you know. And it's like it's a mission for them, and they, you know, they justify apply it in their own mind, like this is like the evolution of humankind, or I'm not sure what I'm trying to get at, but it.
I have a sense of what you're saying. There's a certain level of a pathological misrepresentation in people that they see that they're fulfilling this mission, but it's so distorted and unreal in a sense that they, I don't think they kind of see, you know, the evilness of it all, or the,
I don't think they do either. And it's based on this kind of pseudo intellectual philosophizing Huxley and certain economists but I see it's the old kind of quackery of intellectual quackery.
Well, it's interesting because just getting back a little bit, like, to the heart doctrine, is that once you're sort of exposed to this idea, once you're exposed to this idea that the normal waking state of consciousness is not proper consciousness, it's not really waking consciousness, but is rather, should be, in Gurdjieff's term, should be understood as a waking sleep, and that people are under a spell of psychological illusions about themselves, that they know themselves, that they can do, that they have will, and that they're awake because they can hear you and understand you. You begin to, like, once you're challenged by that basic idea that everything is happening, you know, rather than people doing things, that everything is happening, and that there's like this great sleeping world going on, you know, that people eat and think and drink and act and do everything in a state of semi-hypnotic hypnotic associative existence. Like, there's not proper consciousness, that people don't really have a real sense of their I. They're not really connected to their real self. When you have those basic ideas and then you listen to the explanations of everything, it's sort of like you recognize the lies that everything is framed in terms of and explained, and you start to kind of realize that it's like everybody's sort of mad, and one group of madmen have this explanation of what's going on, and another group of madmen have another explanation. But really, on some basic level, you just see how everything happens and everything is in sleep. And then when it comes to the explanations of consciousness from a contemporary scientific and psychological perspective, you realize that that's part of the madness, in a sense, is that these head cases have come up with all these fantastic theories about consciousness and life, and really, when you look at them closely, they don't really make any sense. No matter how much people repeat them, they really don't explain things at all, and that we really are confronted with these profound mysteries as to the nature of existence and the nature of our purpose here. And from that perspective, you kind of realize that that everything consists of like varying degrees of lies and untruths, but nobody kind of recognizes the lies that underlie everything, and so it's kind of a peculiar experience, in a sense. Like, when you're first, like, in terms of my own personal experience, when I first started studying myself and realized that I was asleep, it was inspiring to understand that and to begin to recognize that, to see the possibilities of what it would mean to be awake. But in part two, it's like it's sort of awakening to the nightmare condition, you know, the nightmare parable from the Gnostic Gospels. You just see how everything consists of this massive movement of sleep and the lies and illusions that accompany it all.
Yeah. Yeah, I see that so differently now, just having woken up over the last few years, like realizing this incredible false consciousness system engendered by the media and our education, and how this has been deliberate, like there's been this dumbing down of humankind, you know, a denial of the spirit and soul possibilities, and But just, it's like everything we've been told by the media has been a fraud. It's all been a lie, you know?
Yeah.
It's all these wars and the causes of wars and everything. The whole thing has been a lie. You know, the fact of the idea that we have democracies, you know, there are no democracies. It's you know, it's a soap opera, you know, and both political candidates are controlled by the same elites and it's part of the same game and the whole thing's a fraud, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even, you know, just having any kind of a skeptical attitude towards everything, I mean, we were talking with Don off air before we started the show, and Don said it's like a bad play, and I said, you know, I'm shocked when I listen to everything that passes as informed discourse about politics and the debates between the candidates in the United States and Canada and other countries, and you realize that to me it's just so apparent that it's so divorced from the reality of everything that, you know, that nobody ever asks any meaningful questions because all the assumptive framework is so out of contact with reality that it's just like this babble that goes on. That really, I got into the point where I just, you know, I not only can I not take it seriously, I can't believe that people can't see through this and don't, you know, demand more of people in the political process.
Yes, it's funny when you wake up to it and it becomes more and more visible, like what a big charade and lie it is.
Yeah.
Like it's such a joke. Like I watch CNN and they say the most trusted name in news. And it's like, yeah, I trust you to lie and deceive us about all the major events happening in our society. It's a complete propaganda. It's a complete lie.
Yeah.
You know?
It's interesting, though, to read, you know, to read history from that perspective. You understand sort of, you recognize more and more that how consistently this goes on, like, you know, all the different levels of lying and the massive manipulation of public opinion. I would say that's probably the, you know, the greatest characteristic of the 20th century is that, just, you know, with the development of technology, it's become, people are more informed, but in a way they're less informed because they're more easily manipulated. You know, I think that's really the, that's really the most kind of profound aspect that's accompanying the development of technology is it's just easy to manipulate people. And in
a sense, that's
one of the real strengths of the internet is that it allows people at least to explore and look for alternative explanations and commentaries on things, which is really good because you know, you're not just stuck with the newspapers and the television or the radio. And the, you know, even what you were 25 years ago, 20 years ago, you know, it's. But then again, you know, despite all the information, I can't get over the fact that, let's put it this way, that, you know, 52% of New Yorkers in 2004 didn't believe the official story surrounding 9/11, and yet this.
Sorry, what percent?
54%.
Wow. Yeah.
52, 54, something like that.
Yeah.
2004 didn't believe the official version, and yet nobody ever discusses this. You know,
yeah.
It's like more than half the population doesn't believe the official explanation of the most important event of the second half of the 20th century, well, the first part of the 21st century, but, you know, the most important event really since in America, since the, and worldwide in a sense because of the implications for what's everything that's happened since, you know, and yet nobody ever questions it or wants to discuss it in the mainstream media. It's just so invisible. But, you know, having said that, I mean, I'm sort of used to it. Like I say, for 40 years, people haven't believed that Kennedy was assassinated by Lee Harvey Oswald. It doesn't make any difference, you know. I mean, they still produce these idiotic documentaries from time to time that raise all these questions at the end and say, well, he probably did it, you know. It was just so clear, like, to anybody who actually, you know, bothers to look at the evidence that he didn't do it, you know. And yet, it's profound because, I mean, somebody murdered the President of the United States in you know, but a country that alleges that it's the greatest democracy on the face of the earth, and yet it doesn't really matter, you know, like it doesn't lead to anything. So
it's
sort of this
terrible,
incredible disconnect between the reality and you know, business as usual. It's like, you know, these things bear some explanation, you know. It's really, it just kind of shows how everything happens. You know, that's the way I would sort of interpret it. I mean, I don't see it as being as deliberate as you do. I just think it's like, I mean, there's certainly lots of deliberate bad things going on. Don't get me wrong, but I just see that people are so asleep, you know, on so many varieties of levels that.
I mean, it's amazing, you know, the Yankees or the New York City has a baseball game, you know, you can get 50 or 70,000 people out for a game of baseball.
Yeah.
You know, and a schedule of probably like 80 home games or something, you know. And you get like 40, 50, 60,000 people out, you know, for a baseball game, men playing games with balls, you know.
Yeah.
But then, you know, the 9/11 protests probably, you know, maybe get a couple hundred, you know.
Yeah,
like,
but
where are people's values at? Like, you know, that's part of the modern society is all this titillation and games and that kind of, we're given so much but so little.
Yeah.
You know, and all this kind of sensationalism about Hollywood stars and their trials and tribulations and things.
Yeah.
And
I mean, it doesn't matter if there's genocide in Darfur, you know, just as long as people get their Britney Spears fix or whatever. It's really... Well, John Lennon said it best in Working Class Hero, you know, 35 years ago when he said, you know, you keep you doped with religion and sex and TV and you think you're so clever and classless and free, but you're still laughing peasants as far as I can see. You know, working class hero is something to be. And that's a very, you know, it's very insightful because, that, like I say, that was 35 years ago, but it, even more so now, you know, it's like we are sort of doped with, you know,
sex
and religion and sex and rock and roll, sex and rock and roll and religion and sports and TV, you know, it's like, now the internet and. There are many narcotic influences, you know. Like years ago, William Burroughs wrote, he wrote a series of books, but Naked Lunch, you know, and I mean, Naked Lunch is essentially about the addictive psyche of the American public, you know, and what they're addicted to. He was addicted to drugs, but, you know, people are addicted to illusion and titillation, as you say, so. But
I don't
know. I was going to ask you to perhaps comment a little bit more. That was really interesting. That quote from Blavatsky was really, really interesting. Maybe you could just speak a little bit more about how you derived the zero point teaching from Blavatsky's work and what she says about zero points, because we haven't gone into that for a while. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's such a complex subject. Like, I've been trying to study zero point, these ideas now for 15, 20 years, and still it's, you know, the term zero point's used in different ways, and it's very subtle and complex. It's quite hard to describe. Really, what zero points refer to and the different ways the term can be used and so on. The Secret Doctrine is interesting because it begins with Blavatsky says an archaic manuscript is in front of her, and she says on the first page is a circle against a dull black background. And on the second page is a circle with a point in its center. And then she kind of, so that basic symbol of a circle with a point in its center, in a way that represents the first point of differentiation of any living cosmos. So that's one way I think it's useful to think of zero point sources, that things originate from a point source and they grow within without from what would appear to be a point source. So that's one idea that's in Blavatsky. And then at other points, she has this quote I use a lot in my writing. She says, a second, find the quote here. Material points without extension are Leibniz's monads, and at the same time, the materials out of which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. The entire universe concentrating itself, as it were, in a single point. So in this quote, it's like she's suggesting there are gods and other invisible powers, which I think of as being in higher dimensional space. And the influences and intelligences of these forces manifest from the level of zero-point sources. So that these gods and other invisible powers, they clothe themselves in bodies based on zero-point centers. So that the influences of the higher dimensions manifest within without from the level of a point source. So she says material points without extension are Leibniz's monads. So again, this is another way of thinking of a zero point center. A monad is a zero point, like it's a spark of divine fire, which kind of exists in higher dimensional space. So a monad, or in the yogic teachings, it would be the jiva atma, the individual spiritual spark. So I think of a monad or a divine spark within the human being, that those can be described as zero point centers. So sometimes that's kind of describing an element like a monad that exists as a tiny little element down at zero point levels. Other times it's concept of zero points. Zero points are portals. They're levels at which influences from higher dimensions manifest within without in the physical world. So there's different meanings to the term zero point. Sometimes it's like they're portals. Other times it's like there's these elements, these zero point elements, these divine sparks. I mean, I guess a lot, 25 years ago, I read some of Shirley MacLaine's book, Going Within, and I always remember her saying, basic idea of the New Age is that we all have the God spark within us. So I became interested, what would that mean, a God spark? What could a God spark be? You know, to try to understand the science of what that could be, how that could be possible. And in a way, a God spark is a spark that's so fine that it's beyond the level of our material perception. So in a way, it's a zero-point element, meaning it's beyond the level of our perception. It would disappear from view from a physical perspective. So there's some meanings of zero point, the idea of the first point of differentiation of a cosmos, the idea that each human being would have a divine spark or a God spark within them, that would be a zero point. Zero points can be portals between levels in the hierarchies of creation, like between dimensions within the levels of creation. So the term zero point can be used in these different senses.
I think this it's very important in trying to grasp this. Is one of the main ideas in the mystical and esoteric teachings is the idea that human beings have different levels of consciousness and being different levels of bodies that exist in different levels of dimensions, but we're not aware of these, and that we're multidimensional beings who exist in a multidimensional universe, and that there are beyond the material plane and the physical universe, there are these higher dimensions which in the scheme that you've just described are connected somehow through these zero points, and that these higher levels are higher levels of intelligence and consciousness, and that they inform the worlds below them, and that there's this idea of that there's a ladder of creation which originates from the absolute or God or whatever the unity, the oneness that underlies everything, and that sort of descends through various levels of materiality and consciousness and informs each level below it, and that this idea that you know, in a sense, human beings are the microcosm, our microcosms and the macrocosm, that we too are, we're multidimensional beings, that we're physical beings, but in order to understand what a human being is, to a comprehensive explanation of what a human being is, you have to go beyond the material. So whereas modern science and psychology tries to explain consciousness and mind as and life as being properties produced by the physical processes in the physical body, mystical and esoteric teachings suggest that no, the process of the physical body and the consciousness of the brain, the operations of the mind are informed by these higher levels within ourselves, which are these higher levels of consciousness above the physical, and so that a comprehensive explanation has to go beyond the physical and material planes to explain these things. And so that's where I see in your work, this is such an interesting extrapolation from the mystical and esoteric teachings. Two things. One is the heart doctrine, which is your explanation that, and it's really quite astounding once you're aware of it, that throughout the mystical and esoteric teachings, this idea that the heart is the center of the human being, and that consciousness and life principles arise in the heart from these higher dimensions, this idea is repeated throughout esoteric and mystical teachings. It's in all of them, all of the major teachings. And yet people, even people who are familiar with this, don't seem to recognize it or don't seem to grasp the importance of this in explaining consciousness and mind. And then the idea that from Blavatsky of the zero points actually provides, as you say, the zero point has different meanings, but I mean this idea of being a portal or as being an element, a spiritual spark. These are like profound ideas in the context of the idea that, and it's only in this context that we're multidimensional beings in a multidimensional universe. So we have to go beyond the physical and the material to explain life and consciousness and who we actually are and what we can actually become through the development of consciousness. And I think that's the astounding thing about the whole history of the mystical and esoteric tradition, is that throughout history, people have transformed their consciousness and had these realizations of higher states of consciousness and being, spiritual states in which they know themselves and know the universe and know God and have these profound insights into the natures of things. And this is, if this didn't exist, then this would all just be talk to me. Like this would, but this is based on the science of the soul. This is empirical in the sense that people have observed these things repeatedly. So they're not making them up, and they're not sort of just picking them out of thin air and trying to, you know, to develop these ideas. People have actually experienced these things and extrapolated out of their experiences to describe these concepts and these visions of what the nature of reality is. So that it's a profoundly different way of looking at things. And based on my own experience, your experience, and our study over 35 years, I think we're both in agreement that from that perspective, really everything in modern science and psychology, almost all of it, is in some way it's fundamentally flawed, but it has things backwards. It's trying to explain everything from the bottom up rather than trying to recognize that, yes, there are processes that become increasingly complex from the bottom up, but also that there's this involutionary process where information and consciousness and higher states of being descend somehow into these lower planes, and so it's a really extraordinarily different perspective on things.
Yeah, and it really takes time to grasp it and meditate it and contemplate it and experience it, and that's something that takes place over years and in our inner study and such. So they're not simple ideas to grasp. But we do find such ideas, as you say, like in the different mystical and esoteric religious traditions. So the idea of there being a God spark within the human being, I mean, it's you know, it's the Jiva Atma in the Vedic teachings. It's the divine spark of the Sufis. It's the divine spark in Christianity, a spark of holiness in Kabbalistic teachings. It's Blavatsky's monad. You know, people use different terms to describe this. And we see the idea in different religions, but it's part of the hidden side of religions. Like, people only generally know the external or exoteric side of religion. And so they see religions are all competing philosophies and different moral standards and so on, and different names for God and different beliefs. So people only see the external side of religion and don't realize that these teachings of the heart are like the essence of the different religious traditions, and that this teaching is what combines the different religions. Like, I think the problems of humankind today on this planet is when people realize that Christians, Jews, Muslims all share the same sacred teachings of the heart in their religions, and that that is the inner teaching of the religion. And the outer aspects are where we differ in. That's understandable because of how religions grow up in different cultures and periods and so on. But they all do share certain esoteric teachings. And that's what's kind of in the occult traditions. It's the occult side of religions. And so people see religion as creating animosity and conflict in the world, but it's kind of a false understanding. Like, I see the New World Order kind of wants to get rid of religions, and they like to portray, you know, 9/11 was an attack by Muslims who hate the American freedoms, kind of, you know, but the whole thing is a crock. You know, the Muslims didn't do it. It wasn't avid Muslims. You know, it was other people and occultists. These people are actually occultists. They're very interested in these aspects. But they portray it then. It's like I can see them wanting to erase religious differences and portray, and there's no recognition of what's essential to the different religions. And I think the world will change when Christians, Jews, and Muslims of religious feeling combine together and, you know, arrest all these deviants within our ranks who were the problem the whole time. It wasn't the problems weren't really caused by religion, not what religion should be. It's so discouraging. I look around at what is the church today. I guess I grew up as a Christian, so I identify with being Christian in ways. And it's so disheartening. It's like, holy smokes, you know, in Christianity is like, you know, love your neighbor as yourself and, like, don't murder people and all these guys. I thought that's what Christianity was about. And then you see it today, you know, it's like, religious fanatics, they support the wars and domination, and they don't see anything of what they've become, and the Christian church has supported this. How could the... It's so discouraging to see what's happened in our world. You know?
That's one of the places where I really see the value of Gurdjieff's concept of octaves, and he says that, you know, that everything that precedes obeys the law of three, the sacred law of three, and the sacred law of seven. And the law of seven refers to the law of the octave, which means that everything, nothing proceeds in a continuous fashion. That there are processes, and he compares it to the musical scale, where there are two intervals that in any process that need to be filled somehow with a shock in order for the octave to proceed and to be fulfilled in a straightforward fashion, but that this rarely happens, and that everything, all activity consists of these octaves, which reached a certain point and then are either stalled or deviate, and the idea of deviation in octaves is a really interesting idea, because he said, you know, you can take an idea or some sort of a philosophical idea or a religious idea, and you can see how it proceeds to a certain extent, and then it deviates, but it still preserves its former name. And yet it's become something quite different because the octave wasn't fulfilled properly. So he said the best example is in Christianity, where you have this, you know, think of how many deviations in the octave of the history of Christianity there have to be to go from Christ's teaching of the Sermon on the Mount with this love of one's neighbor and compassion and love to the Inquisition when people were burning heretics, quote-unquote, in the name of God, or the scholastics calculating how many angels could dance on the head of a needle, you know, or of a pin. Like, it's absurd, but still all these people call themselves Christians, you know. So now today we have all these different denominations and all these different interpretations of Christianity, and yet these are really deviated octaves. Like, these are exoteric aspects of Christianity. Same thing with Islam, same thing with Judaism, same thing with Buddhism. You have all these different people calling themselves Christians or Jews or Muslims or Buddhists, but really the differences between them are enormous. And again, in Gurdjieff's terms, is that there are different religions for different types of people. And so for people in the normal waking state, there's a religion of man number one, which is the physical man, and then there's a religion of man number two, who is more emotional man, and this is man in the generic sense, and then man number three is the intellectual man. But he said, you know, that what they have in common is that these are all religions of people who are asleep on some significant level and who really don't understand the real meaning of their religion. And then there's the religion of a higher man of the realized human being who's developed self-consciousness. And then there's the religion of a man number five who's got an even higher level of consciousness and being. And in that context, what he says that I think is really so significant and really informs the whole debate about religion today and its place in our society is that religion consists of belief and doctrine, but it also consists of doing. And, you know, he said, you know, when people asked him in his meetings in the 20s, you know, about being a Christian, he said, well, the important thing to understand is that you can't be a Christian. You know, Christ teaches to love thy neighbors and to forgive them, you know, and he said, you can't do that because you're asleep. You know, you're a sleepwalker and you don't do anything. You don't have will. You're not master of yourself. So that really, that teaching, he said, you have no right to call yourself a Christian. Well, I mean, a lot of people would be offended by that, but that's my perspective from an esoteric perspective, is that all the exoteric religions are just, you know, they have their place and they fulfill certain functions, some of them good, some of them bad, you know, some of them horrifically bad because people end up killing people in the name of religion, which is absurd. But this idea that something starts out like from an esoteric origin and becomes a philosophical school or a teaching of some sort of religious teaching, but then gets an external organization imposed on it, which becomes the exoteric representation of the esoteric idea. Well, it has the same name, but it's not the same thing. It's the same with anything else in the history of human beings' attempts to know themselves and to develop consciousness and being, like alchemy. Was a process for knowing oneself and various magical practices and astrology. Well, there's astrology, which is today's horoscope in the newspaper, and there's astrology, you know, for exoteric and esoteric astrology. I mean, they're completely different things, even though they have the same name. And the people who actually know something about astrology, are very, very removed from the people who, you know, like I say, print this thing in the newspapers. And it's really the same way with religion and all these other teachings.
Yeah, it's funny how you see today, like, the big thing in the churches seems to be prosperity consciousness, eh? It's like the whole thing is God wants you to prosper and have lots of money, kind of. So it's like, I don't know, it's like The Secret, you know, that movie, The Secret?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which is like how your thoughts kind of create your reality. So, you know, you kind of want to kind of put your thoughts into prosperity consciousness and kind of create that reality for yourself, you know. And my God, you know, it's like, yeah, it's what's become of the Christian church. It's really disheartening, you know. It's instead, in the States, you know, so many of the priests are kind of paid off by the government to be kind of enforcers of, you know, in times of conflict or civil unrest, you know, and it's terrible, you know. It's like, why aren't Christians outraged by what's been done by our people within our society against Muslims and Arabs, and you know, why don't Christians want to know the truth? You know, it's like everybody lives in this collective psychosis. You know, it's like this lie. It's very disheartening.
Yeah. I was struck in sort of another angle on this, too. This whole debate is that, you know, in researching material for the book that I'm working on, The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, and looking at people like Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and Carl Sagan and all these people who've written, Sam Harris have written these books about the dangers of religion and how science is doing away with the need for religion and really providing a comprehensive explanation of everything, and that really God is being squeezed into the gaps and everything. Christopher Hitchens, the journalist, has a book, God Is Not Great. And I heard him on the radio about 6 months ago, and I think it was from England. I think it was a debate. It might have been the Debating Society at Cambridge or someplace. But anyway, it was... The resolution had to do with, you know, is God great, or, you know, is religion necessary? Something along those lines. I don't know exactly the topic because I caught this in mid-discussion. But one of the things he said, which was really funny, was like, you know, this is an example how you could be so right about something and entirely wrong at the same time. He was saying that, you know, that people point out that, you know, he's a militant atheist, and he says that religion is, you know, God is not great, and religion's responsible for all these horrors that have happened, and that intolerance and ignorance is what religion perpetuates. And so he said, you know, and when people point out to him, he said, when people bring up the fact that you know, two of the greatest political systems for murdering and perpetuating ignorance and causing untold suffering were you know, Stalin's the Russia and Mao's China, you know, which are communist and therefore atheistic. He said, he got all indignant. He said, don't you dare suggest that this is the same thing. He said, it's one religion is one thing, and This is the same thing, because it's a state religion, it's the same thing because it's a state religion. And he said they're not really atheistic, because they're inculcating the same kind of blind obedience and belief. Well, yeah, that's the point. The point is that it doesn't matter if people are blindly led by hatred and stupidity, whether it's the name of religion or the name of socialism or the name of fascism or whatever political system or whatever philosophical idea you want to say. The point is, that underlies it all, is that it's a manifestation of waking sleep. It's a manifestation of people not being properly conscious and not being awake, that they're so easily manipulated. So it doesn't, in a way, he's sort of undermining his own point. It's a psychological condition. It's got nothing to do with religion. Religion doesn't make you inherently evil or stupid or lead you to commit awful deeds in the name of God. It's blind obedience to misinterpretations and misrepresentations of things that leads people to, you know, to create crimes and to murder people blindly and to follow these, you know, awful ideas. So I thought it was kind of peculiar, you know, because like you say, on a certain level he was right, but on another level he's completely wrong.
Yeah. I mean, I see it as a complete lie because I see him, a person as him. He knows the Muslims didn't do 9/11. He knows it. The whole thing is a fraud.
Well, I don't know he does. But then,
okay. Yeah, I believe he does.
I don't know.
These people who can't bring that out as an example of religious fanaticism, they know the truth of it. It had nothing to do with Muslim fanaticism.
Yeah, I'm not sure why you think that. I'm not sure that everybody does know this. I mean, I think a lot of people...
I guess I see a lot of these people and these books have become popular. They're part of the kind of New World psychiatric disordered philosophy that's promulgated. They have various people they like who fit their New World Order psychiatric disorder agenda, and what they and one of the ideas is you kind of I see the New World Order kind of wants to get rid of religious differences and have some kind of I'm not sure what they want exactly. One World Order control. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
All the skeptic societies, because the New World Order, I think, knows very well that all these psychical realms and things exist. So they've funded these kind of skeptical groups, and they funded. You know, it's like the Rockefeller influence interpenetrated the whole educational system and all these think tanks and institutes that come out with the most ridiculous kind of stupid propaganda, like it's so superficial, and you know, the RAND Institute and all these think tanks and which I see as having such a kind of mentally disturbed philosophy.
No, I don't get that. Like, I mean, to me, it's just pretty much that people,
See, like when you watch the news, you watch CNN, and you get all these people come up, and they're all these important people, and they all have nice clothes, and they work for these institutes, and they're experts on Islamic terrorism and terrorism, and all these pseudo experts come up, and they have all their kind of propaganda to kind of maintain the complete fallacy of the whole thing. They're complete liars. Everything they say is a lie. That's how I see it.
Yeah,
and they know it. They're part of it. They're paid.
I don't agree with that. I very strongly disagree with that. I don't think they know it. I think a lot of them believe these things that they say. You know, to get back to psychic realities and denial and skeptical. I mean, to me, like, it's just that, to a certain extent, that I don't think that involves any great conspiracy on anybody's part, in a sense that I think that really that's an expression of the fact that it's just sort of a lower level of the mind, is that people who are hard-headed, quote-unquote, materialists, hard-headed materialists are essentially not able to go beyond the literal interpretation of things in the mind. It's kind of scientific fundamentalism in a way that they just think that what they see is all that's real. And I think that's just property of the psyche. Like Maurice Nicole talks about that in Living Time. He talks about that sort of lower level of the mind and how in the normal waking state that being satisfied with material explanations and only that which you can observe is real. I mean, there's a long philosophical tradition of that in the West too, but I mean that it's actually a function of the mind. I see that. I mean, 30 years ago, I think I would have been in that camp, or 35 years ago, even though I sort of wasn't completely sold on it because of my own anomalous experiences with psychedelic drugs and some of the things that had happened to me in my life that made me kind of wonder, like, well, it seems that material explanations provide a pretty good understanding of things, but not really. I mean, there was, to me, like, there was always, like, I was an atheist too. Like, I thought, well, I don't believe in God. You know, I mean, that's just for simple-minded people who are too lazy to realize to see beyond the kind of myth of the Bible and that the unreality of it all. But then, you know, like I say, there's always, to me, these nagging doubts about things, and I think a lot of people are like that. I think people don't have nagging doubts. They just think, well, if I can't see it, if I can't touch it, if I can't taste it, feel it, you know, smell it, then it isn't real. And I think that's just a state of the psyche. And I think these people are well intentioned. I think they're quite wrong about everything, but I don't really believe that they're all part of a conspiracy or that they're serving anything. You know, I mean, they're certainly serving something, but
Well, I mean, different people are compartmentalized a lot, so they don't grasp the larger whole of which they're
part. That's partly what I'm saying, too. Is that, yeah, that's,
but I do, like, I just see it in so much of the, well, I see it on all the kind of experts they bring on the news and on TV, and I see what liars they are and how they're what they promulgate and propagate is just amazing, you know?
Well, I mean, but even in you know, scientific circles, and I, again, like, I think this is just, like, I read some of this stuff, and I think, okay, I don't know where these people are coming from, but, like, that book by Susan Blackmore that we've talked about before, Conversations on Consciousness, where she gathers all these experts on consciousness, you know, and they talk about consciousness. It's for 300 pages. Profoundly stupid book in the sense that, you know, there's hardly any interesting commentary on consciousness in the entire book, I would say. Like, it's just people buying into the same assumptive framework for the most part and arguing things that are entirely imaginary. And I mean, the worst offenders are people like Dennett, who, you know, essentially deny that consciousness is anything other than really just a name for the functioning of the brain, you know, and it's really nothing more than random neural networks, you know, that account for everything, and that, you know, this is all this just huge random process, physical process, which is completely and utterly idiotic when you examine it, I think, with any kind of an open mind. I don't understand how people can believe these things, but I think they sincerely do believe them. And then you get somebody like John Searle, who's supposed to be this great philosopher of consciousness and the mind, and he says at one point, well, what we do know is that every experience of consciousness is caused by the neural processes in the brain. Every damn one of them. You know, he actually says that. Every damn one of them. Like, you know, well, as I was writing about him, he sounds like a guy who probably, you know, kicks his television set to make it work better. I mean, just because you swear at something doesn't mean makes it more true, you know. Like, I mean, but it's a really interesting statement because we don't know that. I mean, there's no scientific evidence for that. It's an assumption, and it's a pretty bad one when you really look at it from our perspective. But, you know, this guy's he's a philosopher of mind and supposedly an expert, you know. Mark Twain said an expert was just some damn fool from out of town, you know. But, yeah, it's amazing what passes for informed commentary on these issues, you know. And as I say, like, I sort of sit back sometimes and I think, you know, everybody's lying all the time about these things, you know. None of these people know what they're talking about.
It's like it's like what Blavatsky says about all this head learning.
Yeah.
Like, I see these people, in a way, they ascribe such magnificence kind of to the brain and the mind and the head and the cerebral cortex. And, and it's like they're so overdeveloped mentally in themselves, intellectually, mentally. And they have these kind of philosophies. You see it in, like, you read Bertrand Russell and these kind of English intellectuals and Huxley, different people, and you kind of see the...
Well, I don't think Huxley fits into that.
Yeah, and I didn't actually mean to say Huxley.
Yeah.
Bertrand
Russell's a very good example. Like,
Bertrand Russell, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like it's so overdeveloped mentally, and that's kind of how I see the elites in a way. It's like they got the eye doctrine, the head doctrine, and they're so developed mentally, but these people have no heart and souls. Like, they're a breed apart in a way. They don't have the kind of normal emotional feeling function of the heart. Like I wonder, like, how could people kind of, to make money, be willing to put poisons in inoculations or to spray people with chemicals from the air because then more people get sick and then you make more money selling them pharmaceuticals and controlling all the doctors. So all the doctors do is sell your pharmaceuticals and you suppress, you know, real medicines and you kind of want to prevent people from having vitamins and minerals, you know, and you do all these devious things to make money and to have power and control.
Yeah.
Like, imagine doing things like this. But there are these breeds of people, kind of, who have no hearts and souls. And their mind, like the mind in the head is they big egos in their mind in the head, but they have no heart or soul that they would be willing to do such things. I mean, it's to most people. I mean, I remember the quote from Edgar Hoover. He says when a person, something to the effect that the average person is kind of at a disadvantage because they can't imagine anything as monstrous as the kind of conspiracy that there really is. Like this conspiracy, yeah. Are you familiar with that quote?
Who said this?
J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI,
what
I guess.
What are you talking about communism?
No, he was talking about like the shadow black government in the United States and the military-industrial complex.
Andrew Hoover said that?
Yeah, that the average person is at a disadvantage because they can't imagine anything as monstrous as this whole system. That's, you know, it's funny. I just last night I watched. Have you ever watched the movie Zeitgeist?
No.
Oh, you haven't, eh?
No.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was, after Loose Change, it's probably the most watched internet movie ever. I think it's the second, and you should really watch that. And there's a new part to it. It's called Zeitgeist Addendum. And I just watched this last night, and a lot of it goes into the financial system and the Federal Reserve and the creation of money as debt and a lot of material along that line. What was I trying to, goodness, what was I trying to come to? And then it goes through. It goes into the fellow who's the economic hitman. Have you heard him?
Yeah, John Perkins.
Yeah, and it had sections of him, and he was kind of like, they went through the history of kind of American involvement in Iran and how they, you know, there was a democratic person there who wanted to kind of restore the oil wealth to the country, and they had him assassinated and replaced him, and they funded that, and it was a CIA operation. And then they did the same in Ecuador, and then in Panama, and then in
Guatemala.
You know, went through a whole series of them, and it was the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, the CIA and the corporate elite who go in, and they impoverish people, and they take the wealth out, and they put their puppets in power, and they murder people. And all the time, it's like, what's the money and power?
Yeah.
You know, and it's hard to imagine, like, I don't know.
I wanted to go back to what you're talking about these head cases, because I think that's really... Like when you're talking about Bertrand Russell, you know, these guys with big brains and egos to match, you know. And I was thinking, well, first of all, I thought about Herman Kahn, who was IQ that was off the charts. And he worked for the Rand Corporation and did all these kind of gaming things where processes where he sort of tried to scheme out how many people would die in a nuclear war, you know, and, you know, what kind of acceptable casualties there would be and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, really, really kind of diseased guy, you know, in a very serious way. It's like, you know, a real kind of Dr. Strangelove figure.
Yeah.
But then, like, that's how Dennett strikes me. It's like, this guy's really smart. He's really, really bright, but he's so full of himself. Like, it's, you know, he's kind of nauseating. I've seen him interviewed, you know, and he's like, he's just, I mean, well, like I said, consciousness explained. I mean, the title sort of says it all, that, you know, I figured this out. Well, how did you figure it out? Well, I thought about it, you know, and I came up with this explanation of it all. and it's really, you know, nothing but an illusion. But, I mean, I try to read that book. It's like one of the worst books I've ever read in my life.
Yeah, it was horrible.
50 pages.
Absolutely horrible.
Absolutely pathetic, you know.
Yeah.
And this guy's trying to... claiming he's explained consciousness, you know, and he's really self-satisfied. When you see, as I say, when you see him interviewed, he's very confident that he's got it all figured out, you know. And that struck me when you said that about big brains and big egos, you know, that this is the kind of character that you're dealing with. But then I was reminded of that great story and autobiography of a yogi, and I think this really sort of addresses the essence of the whole situation when about contemporary thinkers, and I underlined thinkers, and psychologists and scientists talking about the unreality of God and spirit. This Yogananda's guru was Sri Yukeswar, and there was a very prominent Indian chemist came to speak with him, and the chemist was arguing, well, that, you know, there was no evidence for God, and he went on about, you know, the lack of physical evidence, and Sri Yukeswar at the end sort of scolded him, said, "So you have inexplicably failed to locate God in your test tubes. I suggest that you examine your own thoughts for 24 hours and wonder no longer at the absence of God." You know, which is basically, yeah, you're so full of yourself, there's no room for God, you know, there's no room for spirit. And this is like the false consciousness system of that's created by too much head learning and too much trying to reason everything out rather than trying to, you know, open to the it's the mistaking of the thinking and intellectual capacity, that psychic function, for consciousness. They're two different things. Consciousness isn't thinking. And thinking isn't consciousness, you know, and they're two different things. And this is like the sort of fundamental error in the whole Western approach to the study of consciousness. Everybody thinks that it's thinking, or that it's that the predominant
in the mind, in the head,
feature is consciousness is this thinking process in the head, or the processing of information. But that's not it. And I mean, that's where the esoteric and mystical teachings are so clear. When you sit down to meditate, you sit down, you're trying not to think, you know, and really, anybody who takes the time to even do the most perfunctory meditation will quickly learn that thinking goes on all the time, involuntarily. You can't stop thinking, you know, you can't. It should be the easiest thing in the world to do, and it's the hardest thing in the world to do. So, I mean, right there, there's that sort of a glaring anomaly that nobody ever wants to address, you know, and everyone wants to investigate. It's like how they've made this utter confusion in things, you know.
Yeah, and another point in meditation, like I find now that at times I can suspend the turning of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that now I can, and that's what they say. It's the turning of the mind and being caught up in the turning of the mind that prevents us from realizing higher levels of consciousness. And I find at times that I can just...
yeah,
kind of dissolve into my breath, and kind of I experience myself all through myself.
Mm-hmm.
So just be in that existence of that, and kind of sensing and being in space and feeling space all around and things like that.
Do you try to center it yourself in the region of your chest, in the to the right of the upper right part of your heart? Like, is that, do you actually try to do that, or do you find that happens that you get more out of your head and more into your heart? Like, I mean, I'm very much in my head when I meditate, you know, and I can at times, you know, to a certain extent, suspend my thought. But I mean, thinking always just sort of creeps back in, but I have a sense of what you're talking about. But do you find that, like, that you get out of your head and into your heart more?
Well, I find more, I sense myself all through myself, through my blood, and I experience myself in my blood flow all through myself. And that in the heart space, the heart space is like an empty space.
Right.
In the way you think there's an emptiness in the heart, kind of. And I sense this thing, and I, I don't know. There's a way of I can't put these things into words. I've never really exactly. There's a whole. I sense myself in space differently in this kind of life. I can understand the ideas I try to explain about there being a monad in hyperspace. Okay, a human being has a monad, and this thing, entity, element, quanta, your I, your monad, exists in hyperspace, seven-dimensional hyperspace. And this little monad, like a little atom, kind of has spin properties on it, a very intricate little thing, and seven-dimensional little entity. And it has certain spin properties on it. And the spin properties of that are imparted into the space surrounding it, the ethers. And the spin properties then help the create different levels of material surrounding the central point. Okay, seven levels of, so I would say there's seven levels of physical creation which manifest out of seven-dimensional hyperspace. Okay, and then somehow the idea in holographic physics, like if you have this little monadic essence in seven-dimensional hyperspace, and even in itself, like there's another quote from Blavatsky that my writing tries to explore, how she explains the laws of nature. And she says that the great breath, which it modifies its motion on seven invisible points. So she's saying that, like, sometimes I talk about 1 zero point, but then sometimes 7 zero points. So you might imagine this little monadic essence, and within it, it has 7 zero point centers, seven holes dug in space. Blavatsky calls them holes dug in space. So there's this little entity like an atom, and it's got seven-dimensional nature, and it's got these 7 zero point little holes dug in space. So what it is like a mini beyond nano level quantum computer. And these mini seven holes dug in space are essentially black holes. So you have this little element that's a quantum computer element that exists at zero-point levels. And these seven holes dug in space, intelligence and influence can emerge through those holes, or it can withdraw into them. So this little element with this kind of higher dimensional sevenfold zero-point quantum computer element existing in hyperspace, and it has certain spin properties, and there's an equivalence between its spin properties and the material worlds that they're created to surround that zero-point center. So we then acquire different bodies which surround the zero-point center. So then you get rid of the physical body, and you still have the subtle bodies that you're already existing in. We exist in all of the bodies at once. So I have so this idea of this entity in higher dimensional space with these spin properties. See, so I have a sense sometimes of there being such an element in myself in higher dimensions, and its spin properties are imparted to the ethers. So I experience space and things differently than I used to. It's hard to put these things into words.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, you know, in somewhat, I have a sense of what you're trying to say, because I had this experience many, many years ago. I wrote about, I don't know if you remember, in my first book, where I was, I used to lie awake at night and try to experience, just to visualize the chakras and manifesting as my physical body, and like this information kind of inflowing and informing my physical body.
Yeah.
And I would I would try to be aware of like the kind of light coming into me. And at times, like I had experiences where I lost my sense of my physical body, and it was more, I didn't have any kind of sensation, any proprioceptive feedback. I just lost a sense of any kind of physical presence, and I felt more like just like this field of light, you know, and I had these like really kind of profound light experiences that it's very hard to describe in a sense, but that I just, that's what I felt. I felt like there was just this pulsing field of light, like physically, and yet I was still sort of aware of myself, but it was, I kind of had these feelings of sort of higher emotional states where it's hard to translate it, but kind of feeling like inspired and somehow in contact with something higher than myself. It was very, very odd, very, you know, very distinct sensations, but very real, but at the same time kind of difficult because I don't really have a vocabulary to translate what I was experiencing into, you know?
Yeah, I think those feelings are very important. Like, that's how, like, the heart is described as having the bliss sheath. And it's like the more you're in touch with that, your bliss self within the heart, the more we experience an inner blissfulness of being, in being. And so if that was clear to us, that would be a continuous state, but it's not. So we can have glimpses of it and be more in it or more out of it. I think that, like Crowley once said, religious ecstasy is essential to man's soul. So we want to, there's a certain inner ecstasy of being or existence experience connected to the heart. And we want to kind of be in that inner ecstasy, being, existence, experience. And we could be in that constantly as we go around our lives in the mad world. But, you know, ideally that would be constant in us. But so we can be closer to it and further away from it. I mean, a variety of higher emotional experiences come about as you start awakening and opening the heart, like, you know, you can experience the way I've had experiences of going around. It feels like overwhelming love towards people and compassion towards people and just seeing people, being aware of them. That's one kind of ecstasy state. Or another is just kind of pure being, existence, ecstasy state, you know.
Yeah, you know, ecstasy means like ecstasis, eh? Like out of stasis, like, you know, stasis is sort of the main maintenance level, or the, you know, the there's no movement. So
oh yeah,
to be ecstatic is to be out of stasis, you know, which is what in a sense you want to be if you're a sleepwalker. You know, you want to get ecstatic as frequently as possible. So
yeah,
and it's like sort of breaking up the crystallization of your psyche in the patterns of complexes of habits that keep you in a state of waking sleep, and so you want to break those as much as possible. Like, one of the most interesting things comes from Gurdjieff's discussion, and he discussed it, and then he put it into Beelzebub's tales to his grandson. It's in his book when he's talking about the failure in the history of humankind of appeals to develop conscience through the three traditional paths have been through faith, hope, and love. And he talks about how each of these religious paths had failed. And he said that in order to awaken sacred conscience in human beings, it would be necessary for His Endlessness, our Creator, to implant in people something which caused them to, whenever they cast their eyes upon anyone else, to remember the inevitability of their death and of their own. And this idea that what we want to do is, because he spoke about this in one of his early talks, is he said that if your emotional state of presence, when you're going about doing what you do and living your life, if you could remember the inevitability of your own death as well as that of others, everything would change. Now, and this is really an interesting idea because, like, everybody knows that they're going to die, and everybody knows that everybody around them is going to die. We all know that, but that doesn't mean that we remember it. And this is the difference between thinking about something or intellectualizing it and being conscious of it. They're two different things. So to be conscious of this idea that of the inevitability of your own death and that of everyone around you, it's not a thought so much as it's a state of presence, and it's essentially an emotional process. So if you try to cultivate this in yourself, and I try to do this. I try to remember when I'm going about, looking at everybody and realizing, they're going to die. We're all going to die. This is all somehow transitory, and it has an inevitable end to it. It's amazing how you see people very, very differently, and how you see yourself and experience yourself very differently. Like, I've had some really quite profound experiences when I've done that. But of course, the problem is it's really hard to remember it. Like, it's hard to be that way, because you fall back asleep and start interacting normally with people. You see this person and you're pissed off because they've been rude to you, or they cut you off in traffic, or you see this other person and you respond to them sexually because you're sexually attracted to them. You see this other person, you have some sort of judgment about them because you don't like the way they're dressed or the way they carry themselves or the sign they're carrying. So you fall back into all these kind of mechanical reactions to them, and you forget the inevitability of your death and of everyone around you. But it really is, it's such a strange idea, but it's so profound. And I remember coming across a quote from Jack Kornfeld, who writes about Buddhist teachings, and he said, not just Buddhist teachings, but about Eastern religions. He says that in the Gita, Lord Krishna says that something to that effect, that the most amazing thing about human beings is that they can forget the inevitability of their own death and of that of everyone around them. Do you know that to quote, like?
Well, you fall into forgetfulness and sleep.
Yeah.
And the mode of ignorance, ignorance of self. So, yeah.
I just sort of wondered if you actually, I remember reading that, but I've never been able to find it in the Bhagavad Gita. I've never seen it, but anyway.
I don't remember it exactly like that.
Okay, but it's funny because it's such a profound idea, And as they say, I think it's really an interesting idea in the sense it's not just an idea, it's a precept. I mean, it's a direction for action and for presence. But it just really underlines the difference between knowing something or thinking something and being that, and having that state of presence. Because like you say, everybody knows that, they're going to die and that everybody around them is going to die. We all know that, But it's one thing to know it. It's quite another thing to be aware of it and to be conscious of yourself and people around you in terms of that idea.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and I think that's that sort of underlines what we're talking about the difference between consciousness and thinking. Like, that thinking is one thing and consciousness is something quite different. And thought and knowledge are useful to a point, but they're also they're limited until they're translated into action and. Everything is translated into action in terms of an emotional state of presence, which is, can vary dramatically. And so the same ideas can have completely different meanings depending on your emotional state and your emotional level of awareness of things.
I mean, the mystical path can certainly bring diverse kind of different experiential states connected to the heart, and that's really important. I think there's the remorse of conscience is what Gurdjieff describes as the main way for people to undergo a rebirth is through awakening and remorse of conscience. And he sees that as the alchemical fire that burns away the false ego, the patterns of false ego. And then he talks of faith, hope, and love as higher objective emotions, so we could have experiences of those higher emotions. And then he would talk of bearing the sorrow of our endlessness.
I
feel that often. I find that it breaks my heart when I read about all these people everywhere being murdered by people is terrible, you know,
yeah.
And poisoned, and the awful things being done everywhere. Like, it's like, because I don't think that, oh, there are kids over here and there are kids over there. It's like, I feel myself is like all kids are my kids,
yeah.
You know? So I see any child, you know, I would want to be protective of that child and care for that child, have compassion on that child, you know. And then you read all these awful things everywhere, and it's, one is so helpless to do anything about it, you know. So it's like the sorrow of our endlessness. It's like if you think of that aspect of God that kind of bears all the sorrows of all the humankind. You know, and you kind of wake up to it, and you can kind of feel, experience all the sorrow, the horror of the situation, you know, of humankind, what's being done to humankind.
Yeah, that's an interesting kind of idea. I really like that in Gurdjieff, where he talks about, you know, that's one of the sacred being duties is to relieve the sorrow of his endlessness. Is, you know, that we're here to lighten the sorrows of our Creator, to, you know, and in a sense, it's sort of a rejoinder to the complaint from people who say, well, you know, if God's so all, you know, knowing and omniscient and everything, how come there's suffering and death and horror and everything in the human condition? You know, all these awful things happen, and it's like, you know, why didn't he just intervene? But I mean, in a sense too, it's like, you know, God is suffering this, you know, like, I mean, God has to suffer all this stuff that humanity is going through. So
yeah.
It's like, you know, it's not just that God just doesn't intervene, it's that God has to suffer it, you know, like,
yeah.
So I mean, you know, I mean, this is where trying to reason about God gets kind of silly in my mind. It's like, you know, it's God. It's like, you know, I think there are levels beyond our understanding of things, where things are mysterious and we really, really can't explain them, you know.
It is interesting. I mean, that is a thought that's a really interesting thought. Like the idea
thought.
That there could be a God, could be this being that does experience simultaneously all the sufferings of all human beings.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be a zero point field in modern physics. It would be certain zero point field, you know. Just like there's another zero-point field, which is this kind of love that permeates everything, that holds everything together.
Yeah.
That's a zero-point field.
Yeah.
We exist in that field. Whether we feel it or not feel it kind of depends on what we are in ourself and in our state. But that exists as a field that we might experience ourselves within.
Yeah, it's interesting that that's really, I like that, but you say about love, that I don't know exactly. I think through my own experiences of losing my father and having some deaths surrounding that of my father, you know, at one point about, I guess, 7 years ago now, I sort of came to that conclusion, and I it wasn't through reasoning, but just sort of meditating on my father's death and deaths of, you know, of my cat. And, I mean, people who don't, you know, get animals and pets would not understand that. But, someone else in my life, like, I had several deaths in a relatively short period of time, and my kind of, what I came out of that thinking was that, And I didn't reason this, but I have a very strong conviction that, to me, love endures. You know, that the one thing that does endure is love. That's, I feel that in my heart. You know, I can't explain it, but I feel that very strongly, that love is the one thing that endures. You know, everything else is ultimately transitory and ultimately, you know, decay is inherent, as the Buddha says, in everything, but I think love endures, and you know, it's kind of a profound thought, like, as you put it, like, the idea of it, that this zero-point field, you know, is that...
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
I like that a lot, actually.
In Blavatsky, see, it's at the end of time, the Divine Mother ingathers the universe to her bosom.
Hmm.
So in mystical teachings, in a way, love is gravity. Gravity, love is what binds it all together and holds it all together. It's all held together by the love of the Divine Mother. Wow. And this love on different levels of reality is what appears to us as gravity. And it's electromagnetic in influence. Like, gravity isn't what people have thought it is. Gravity is within the electromagnetic zero-point fields. And that gravity on different levels is something inherent to the Divine Mother. And when the body might at death, the body, its center of gravity might be in the earth. But the spiritual soul, its center of gravity is in the higher dimension. So it gravitates to its higher, its center of gravity. So there's a separation of parts within us. But gravity, so might usually mean something falls to the ground, but gravity in the spiritual level means that you might rise into, you know, this higher level of center of gravity within. So love is like a cosmic phenomena that, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's...
I mean, that's why, I mean, that's, well, you know, that goes along like the classic kind of mystical experiences. One is probably like the unity.
Right.
Of like people can feel a unity with nature, like you might go into the woods and experience just dissolving into nature and just feeling everything around you within yourself, kind of unity with nature. Or you might feel unity with other people, that they're all part of one family, and you feel caring and love and compassion to all living beings, you know. You can extend it with animals, you know, and you kind of can merge with things. States of unity on different levels of phenomena. And then the other is kind of the experiences of ecstasy and joyousness inherent to the soul, the kind of blissfulness of being, you know, remorse of conscience, love, faith, hope, compassion, you know, these are some like different higher emotions, what Gurdjieff would call higher emotions. So we want to kind of cultivate higher emotions.
Wow. You know that 5D song by the Birds, 5D? Do you remember that song? I was singing those lines where he says, I open my heart to, it's about acid trips, I guess, but I opened my heart to the whole universe, and I found it was loving, and I saw the great blunders my teachers had made, scientific delirium madness.
Wow.
Yeah.
kind of
pertinent to what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But I mean,
it's so neat how sometimes poets and lyricists songs like embody the most profound esoteric ideas, like that Papa Roach song I like so much, eh?
Yeah.
Where
he
says, everything is nothing, and nothingness is in everything.
Yeah, that's
and
incredible this, lyric.
Well, something that you call your soul, flip it inside out, it's a big black hole, he says.
Yeah.
They say about the soul is a big black hole.
Yeah.
And this nothingness at the heart of being.
Yeah.
You know, and how nothingness is in everything, and everything is nothing, you know. And is this, you know... That's a great song.
Yeah.
From Angels to Insects, that's the name of that song. And it's like within a human being, you know, you got all those levels.
Yeah.
From an angel to the insect.
Yeah. Yeah. Where there's that great Cohen line, I always like, which is sort of what we were just talking about too, where he says, sometimes I forget to pray for the angels. Sometimes we forget to pray for the angels, and then the angels forget to pray for us. Sort of, you know, your spiritual responsibility is that it's not a one-way street, you know, that you don't just petition the, you know, the higher beings to intervene and give you good luck in the lottery, or, you know, you actually have to give something to receive, you know. And I think there's, like, that's a sense, too, that comes from studying yourself systematically or trying to develop your consciousness through mystical or spiritual teaching, esoteric spiritual teaching, is that you realize that there's a certain justice to things on some level, that, you know, that nothing is given for free, but for every effort, real effort you make with real humility, real openness, real love, that you'll be paid in kind, you know, like on some level you'll get back, you know, or you'll be nourished or you'll be in some way given guidance to continue your journey. It's really quite profound how that happens. At least that's my experience. Everything I've read about from other people's experience seems to...
I mean, one thing, if we think of the inevitability of death, then we become concerned about, like, the importance of the soul life. And I think we want to have put something up in heaven, like attain something in our development that to get us through death and
something beyond.
It was interesting last week they had someone on Coast to Coast talking about the fourth turning, and it was kind of an analysis of the generations and how we're in this level of the fourth turning. That's kind of what I see, the opening of the heart chakra. You have three lower chakras, like the first, second, and third chakras, and then the opening of the heart chakra is the fourth turning. And I really think it's said that people controlled by the three lower chakras are controlled by money, sex, and power. And you look at the corruption of the elites and the things they've done within the world, and you see in a way it's all about money, sex, and power. They have no love. They have no compassion. They have no hearts. They lose their souls,
and
have kind of no moral integrity, and just for money, sex, and power, they don't care. You know, they'll poison the environment, they'll murder people, they'll spread poison. You know, just for money, sex, and power, and that's all the life. And in a way, they're the old humanity, and the humankind will only have a new age when people undergo that fourth turning and attain something in the awakening of their hearts and attaining to their souls, and that this is kind of a critical time on this planet in terms of that we have to kind of undergo this transition in a positive way, you know, or else we're facing pretty evil days ahead.
Well,
so we're coming down to time, so I would like to mention the website, www.zeropoint.ca. Jim, thanks for, did you want to have some comment? We may have a minute left.
Yeah, I was going to say we're near the end here, but I just wanted to mention that I'm going to send you a copy of that's The Spiritual Brain, and maybe by 2 weeks from now we have a chance to at least get into it a bit and, you know, discuss it on the next program, because I think...
Yeah, let's do that. I would really like to read that.
Yeah,
also, I've been... reading Science and the Reenchantment of the Cosmos, and why don't we take that up next time?
Oh, yeah, great.
And we'll maybe try to aim for The Spiritual Brain the week after that.
Okay. Your Reenchantment of the Cosmos?
Yeah, it's excellent.
Yeah, hey, by the way, Bob Dylan wrote about 25 years ago that, in Blind Willie McTell, well, God is in his heaven and we all want what's his, but power and greed and corruptible seed seems to be all that there is.
Wow. That's Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
God, unbelievable, some of his lyrics.
Yeah, right? He comes out with some pretty good ones.
Yeah. I hear him, The Masters of War. What an incredible song.
Yeah. He wrote it 40 years ago, and it's just like it's just relevant even more so today.
Yeah, even more so today.
Yeah.
Thanks, BBS Radio, Don and Doug. We'll see you in 2 weeks, Jim.
Yeah, thanks,
Chris.
Thanks, Don and Doug. Keep up the good fight, fellas. Okay, we'll talk to you later. Bye.